During the month of October, you will be reading in the newspapers about the visit of King Olaf V of Norway to many communities here in the United States. This is not an official state visit. It is a visit in connection with the 150th anniversary of the arrival of the Norwegian Mayflower. In 1825, in fact, July 4th, 1825, the first boatload of immigrants from Norway left Stavanger, Norway. I asked someone when I was over there, was this just a historical accident, or did they know something about the day in which they left? And a man who is something of an expert in this area, he said, I'm afraid it was just a coincidence that they left on July 4th. Now, why did they leave Norway? There were 52 people that left, but by the time they came over here, there were 53. A child was born, just as there was a child born aboard the Mayflower. They left because of religious reasons and economic reasons. But perhaps the religious was the one that triggered it. Very much like the Pilgrim Fathers who went over on the Mayflower. And Walther's colony, which became the beginning of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, left Germany because of religious reasons. Now, some of you who are of Norwegian blood would say, perhaps, well, surely they couldn't have left Norway because of religious reasons. About this time, the Napoleonic Wars were going on, well, a little bit earlier than this. And the Norwegians, always being people who sail the seas, either to fish or in the interests of commerce. Some of the boats served the French, some served the English. And they might serve one time and the other another time. A group of men aboard a boat that was transporting material to France were apprehended by the British Navy. And of course, they were arrested and they were taken to Britain and there imprisoned. I'm told that they were not lodged in an ordinary prison, but in a prison ship, and that the difficulties were great. Small space, and the food not too good. Now, when someone who is accustomed to roving the seven seas suddenly gets locked up in small space, you can understand how that would affect such a person or people. But there were some people in Great Britain that were moved to minister to these people, namely the Quakers. And after they were released, sometimes they were invited to stay in the home of some of the Quakers. And a man by the name of Lars Larsen, good Norwegian name, was one of those who was apprehended and later on lived in the home of a Quaker family. And he was so deeply impressed that he decided to become a Quaker. And it was arranged that someone who was knowledgeable in the Quaker belief went with him to Stavanger, Norway. And thus you had the beginning of a Quaker community. This was also the time when Hans Nielsen Hauge was active. And because of the Conventicle Acts of the Parliament in Norway, people couldn't do things except through the state church. You could not be married except it was under the state church. There were a number of other little things that irritated them. And these people began to think, that is, some of them in the Quaker colony that was established in Stavanger, began to think of perhaps going abroad. It so happened that just previous to their sailing, that is some years previous, an adventurer, a Norwegian adventurer by the name of Kling Pearson, went over on his own to the States just to see whether it was true what was being said about the United States, opportunity, and there you could really be free people and so on. And he came back and told stories about what a wonderful country the United States was, and there you could start anew and have your own land and so forth. And the Quaker group had Mr. Pearson come down and talk to them, and they decided that they were going to emigrate. Not all on this boat were Quakers, some Haugianer and some nothing at all. But they made up a boatload. Interestingly, this boat was one that had gone through many changes. It was built in 1801, and it was then built as a fishing vessel, and it was called Incarnation, of all things to call a boat. But this, it seems to me, tells you what kind of people built that boat. People who wanted to say, it seems to me, through that God is with us wherever we are. He is at our side as we fish, and so on. Then later, it was revamped further, enlarged. This time it was called Hobit in Norwegian. Well, again, it seems to me, those who walk in the assurance that God is at their side, they have hope. At least, it seems to me I can read that kind of confession in the people. When the Quakers, or this group, Larsen and his people, bought it, then they enlarged it further, but it was still a small sailing vessel, and they called it Restoration. It was sort of restored. Well, there's meaning in that, too. If you believe God walks at your side and you have hope, then you are daily restored. The hope trickles away, and as you pause before him in prayer and worship, it is restored. They started out with this number of people, and they had some iron cargo that they had hoped to sell in England, and thus get more means to start with when they got to New York. But they weren't aware of some of the customs laws, and so they had no opportunity to sell this. They were sailing down toward the Madeira Islands in order to take advantage of the wind, and then they would go on an angle up to New York. I don't know whether this is apocryphal, but I read one account, one of the newspaper in Stavanger put out, no, this was the one in Oslo, the leading paper in Oslo, put out for the Sunday edition a magazine section. The entire thing was on this. And they told the story that they were getting short on water, and it was so bad that they had become weak, and they were lying around on the deck. And as they came near the Madeira Islands, they saw some casks floating by. And they pulled one of these out of the water. I don't know whether they had any compunctions about drinking wine, but being very thirsty, they drank wine to the degree that it incapacitated them somewhat. And when they got near to a port in the Madeira Islands, the guards could not get any signals from this boat, and he was about ready to level a gun at them. But then suddenly someone stood up and waved a white flag. Well, then they were welcomed, and they got provisions anew, and then set out for New York, and arrived in New York October 9th. That's about 95 days at sea in a very, very small vessel. to be welcomed there by Quakers in New York, but not by the harbor people. They hauled them into court and said that there was a law against there being that many people in so small a boat. They had 23 more than they were supposed to have. And they fined them $150 apiece. I had intended to bring down, I have a facsimile of a pardon issued by President John Quincy Adams. So they were forgiven, and he says something about they being Norwegian immigrants, not knowing anything about the law of the land and so on. It's evident that they did not intend to violate the law, and so this would be a special condition. They were forgiven, and the Quakers direct them up into New York, and they settled there for a while. But it wasn't so easy to wrest a living out of land where you had to cut the trees, and I don't suppose they had dynamite with which to get the stumps out, so you'd have to plant around the stumps, as it were. And then Kling Pearson brought news that out in northern Illinois, well, there was land that was flatter, and he thought would be much better. And so most of them pulled out and settled in northern Illinois. And I think they still have a society there that they call the Society of the Sloopers. The type of boat they had was called a sloop. And President Adams mentioned this sloop, which was a very small sailing vessel. They had nothing other than sails with which to get over here. This was the first Norwegian immigrant boatload of immigrants that went over. There were others that came, in fact, after that, about perhaps 10 years later, then others came, and then the big flood started. In 1925, the Norwegian Lutheran Church of America celebrated the anniversary and encouraged all their congregations to do so. And there was composed a cantata. That's in Norwegian. I haven't seen any translation of it, but it's beautiful. It describes in beauty this slooper lying there in the quiet harbor, ready to stick its prow out into the Atlantic, and then tells a little about the voyage, and then pictures this as a great progression. This was the first fruits of a great progression of people. It came out to settle on the prairies and in the forests. And, oh, it's done beautifully. I wish that some choirs would take that up and sing it anew. They celebrated this anniversary, the 150th anniversary, in Norway this summer, beginning with the 17th of May. And then it reached its climax on the day of the July 4th. And they had the celebration in Stavanger. The main celebration was there. And then it sort of tapered off on Sunday, July 6th. President Preuss and I had been asked to go over to represent the people of Norwegian background in the churches in the celebration over there. Let me try to describe a little bit about the celebration on July 4th. We began rather early, and all of us went down to the dock in Stavanger. And there was a boat that was almost an exact replica of the Restoration. It was docked alongside of the wharf. I think they said it was only 1 foot longer. And there they had 52 people of the comparable ages of the sloopers. There were children, young people, and older people, dressed in the garb of people of that time. They looked almost like a group of Mennonite brethren. When the king arrived from his yacht out in the harbor, and he sat down on a little raised dais, he and the crown prince and the crown princess. And then there was read a little skit, sort of, about the sloopers. And that which was most impressive, everyone was aboard, and then the man who was the leader of the expedition says, Almanumbur, all men aboard. And there was one young couple that was just ready to go up on the little gangplank. The husband carried a wooden bucket on his arm, and he and his wife pause for a moment as they are halfway up. And he says to her, I have soil in this pail from the home place. If anything happens to me, then please remember to take 3 spades of dirt from the home place to put on my coffin. That tells one an awful lot. Then she turns to him as though she would like to get off from that somber theme and says, do you remember when we first met? And she carries something that's covered with a shawl, and I thought maybe she was had an infant there. She says, I was out in the forest, and suddenly, she said, a great fog enveloped me, and I didn't know which way to turn. Then she said, and she took the shawl off, I rang this bell, she said, and suddenly you were there at my side. And then he puts his arm around her and said, and we have been at one another's side ever since, and intimating that they will go on into the new land side by side and we'll have a happy life together there. Then the boat pulled out just down the dock a little ways. Then we all went up to the church, all government officers and guests of various kinds. By the way, there were several guests from the United States representing Congress and the American government. Hubert Humphrey, Senator Mondale, Senator Carver of Iowa, and then Congressman Albert Quay. Humphrey is half Norwegian. Mondale is half Norwegian. He had visited Mundal, where his grandfather came from. He said, maybe if we hadn't changed our name, it might have been worth more votes in Minnesota. But all went up to the cathedral, where we had a service, according to the full liturgy, of Høymesse, the High Mass, as in the Norwegian said, but it's a full liturgical service. And Bishop Olaf Hagesæter, who is the Bishop of Stavanger, this was in the Stavanger Cathedral, preached. And a great choir. They had about half boys, and I understood many of them had come in from vacation, and then all the others adults. And there's a deep chancel and a vaulted ceiling over that chancel. I don't know whether that was it, but it seemed to me that improved the volume and also the quality of the singing. Oh, that was great singing. After the service was over, someone told me Mrs. Brackley, the wife of the Prime Minister, she had said later in the day that that service had for her been the high point of the entire experience. Then after the service, we went on up to a hall, Kuppelsaal, it's called, a sort of a large auditorium. And there they had a fine orchestra on the platform that was playing. And when the time came to, well, no, I won't digress. I'll come back to that later. Sometimes thoughts come to you while you're talking that you ought to include. But As we sat down, we discovered right ahead of us, in the chair ahead of us, was Lee Volman. And of course, that meant there were a lot of photographers that were snapping lights, or snapping pictures of her continuously almost. The program began by a sort of a prologue statement by Alfred Hauge, who was one of the experts on the first immigrants. Then after he had spoken, then King Olaf spoke for about 10 minutes, made a very fine statement. Then after King Olaf, then Lieve Ullmann read some poetry and of course did very well. Then after Lieve Ullmann had spoken, then Senator Humphrey spoke. And in his inimitable way, he never overlooks anything, he had heard that it was the birthday of the princess, the crown princess. So he starts out by turning towards the crown prince, and he said, "May I, on behalf of all of us here, extend our congratulations to the crown prince." And of course, many didn't know that it was a birthday, and oh, they burst out in applause. And then he went on and made a very fine statement. Someone afterwards said, "Wasn't that a marvelous speech?" And somebody commended him in to Mrs. Humphrey. And she casually said, "He always gives good speeches." I thought that was beautiful. That wifely support. Well, after Humphrey, then a man by the name of Olson, director of the National Theater, that's the theater in Norway, this is in Oslo, he read a poem that really was a masterpiece. It involves a lot of imagery, but I thought he did even a better job than Lieve Ullmann did. It's a kind of a picture of the birds are in the Southland, and they're beginning to confer with one another. Is it time to go north? And some suggest we better talk with the swans. They are the wise birds. And this goes on, and then they decide they'll try. And they start out, and they come over Norway, and they see some snow in the mountains, but they see that it's melting and the streams are pouring down and there's beginning to be greenery and flowers are coming out. And oh, he wove that together in such a remarkable way. I said to him afterwards, I thanked him for it. I said, "If you read that piece of poetry before the Restoration left, they would have decided to cancel their plans and stay." Then after he spoke, then the mayor of the city spoke and made some announcements about lunch. And then we went on down to the Atlantic Hotel and were guests of the fylke, that'd be about like the county. It was labeled a lunch, but it was a sumptuous dinner. There were a few toasts at that luncheon, but we had to leave soon to go out to the city park, because there was a piece of sculpture of two deer that had been given by artists in the United States who were of Norwegian stock. And here Mondale spoke. And then the Minister of Foreign Affairs for Norway spoke. Both excellent statements. Then we went from the park back down to the dock. Now it was getting to be around, 6 o'clock or so. And there was a band playing. And where do you suppose that was? From the Burnsville High School in Minnesota. They'd been on a tour and they were playing. Well, Humphrey had scarcely more than gotten there. Well, he waited until they were through with the number. Then he jumped right into where they had the big horn section. And he asked one of the boys if he could get that. And so he puts it up to his mouth. And of course, the photographers, they may have been asleep before that, but they were right there flashing one picture after another. The next day it appeared, of course, on the front page in the newspaper. And it appeared in Time magazine a couple of weeks later. After the music, then there then we had some, there had been some visiting aboard ship, a ship called the Christian Roddick. This was a sailing vessel, a training vessel for the Norwegian Navy. I had at the Kuppelsau sat alongside of the captain of this. And I asked him then, I said, will you go over entirely under sails? He says, yes. I said, don't you have any motor? He said, we have a small auxiliary motor to get us in and out of harbors and in an emergency that could be of help. But he said, we'll go all the way across to Miami with sails only. And there were 80 seamen aboard that ship. And I think he said a complement of officers of 16. That would include the cooks also. So it was quite a crew aboard the ship. This was much larger, of course, than the Restoration. The Restoration might have looked like a life vessel alongside of this Christian Roddick. Well, there was some exchange of toasts there. And then Albert Quay was called upon to speak. Once more, an excellent statement. He probably gave it a more distinctly Christian flavor than the other two. But I must say that no American could have listened to each one of these representatives and been other than deeply grateful that we were represented by such fine men and who comported themselves. You got to see a little of the boy in Humphrey, and I always like to see something of that kind. But in what they said, just great. Then, after going back and having a chance to wash up, then we went to the Atlantic Hotel once more, this time for a dinner that was given by the city of Stavanger. For here you had a double festival. It was the 850th anniversary of the city of Stavanger and the 150th anniversary of the sailing of the Restoration of the first immigrant ship. In the dining hall or banquet hall, we had round tables except where the king sat and a few of the special guests. About 10 of us, I think, at a table. This time we were seated at the table where Senator Humphrey was seated, and also Lieve Ullmann. And right to my left was a former foreign minister. He was so interesting to talk to that I didn't get much chance to talk to other people. But Humphrey, being his real self, he came in a little bit late. He sat down and said, "Phew." He says, "This is a worse pace than we have in Washington." Well, it had been a stiff pace. And he had something extra. He had a sandwich in a visit to some of the Norwegian or the American citizens. You know, Stavanger is sort of the capital of the oil field that Norway has found. And there are many, there's a colony of Americans over there helping. And he had been out there then to give them a 4th of July address and then came back again. I wanted to have a little exchange with Lieve Ullmann, even though she was right across the table. So I asked her, when there was a little pause and a chance to do so, I said, "Which of the Ibsen characters do you like best?" She said, "To be or to play?" I said, "Of course, to play." And then she first spoke Hedda Gabler, and, well, she wasn't sure. I said, "What about Rosmer's home. Oh, she said, I would like to play that too. And well, she's a very easy person to talk with. And she came from Trondheim to Stavanger, and there she began acting. Then she went down to Oslo and was there a while, but didn't make the grade. And then she went back to Stavanger. And it was while she was playing in the theater in Stavanger that she was discovered by some scout. And from then on, it went right on up the ladder. So sometimes even the best experts who regard themselves such may not spot the talent in a person right away. After this period, we adjourned and went to our respective lounges. Depending upon what table you sat at, you went to lounge A or B or C or D. And there we had coffee, the European custom, of course, always coffee after the meal. They think we're queer if we drink coffee with the meal. senatorial or the Congress people, they were ushered into the lounge where the king was to meet him and to chat a little. And then Dr. Price and I were ushered in. And when we were through, I thought probably that was where they'd stop. But King Olaf stayed in that lounge until 12 o'clock midnight in order to shake hands with every American who had been a guest at the dinner. This tells you something about this man. I love him. There are so many thoroughly human stories about him. Let me tell you one which I think is really funny. During the Nazi period, of course he was not in Norway then, nor was his father. During the Nazi period, there was one man in the Oslo area who made it a project to collect food from people who lived where they could raise some vegetables and so on themselves and had more than they really needed, and would quietly distribute it among people who didn't have. Now this was contrary to the rules, and had you been found out, you, the Gestapo, would have taken you in tow. But he got through the war period without being apprehended. After the war was over, remembering all the people who had given him food and clothes to distribute to those who were needy, he thought it would be really a very good idea to have a certificate of thanks given to these people. Then he thought it would really be worth something if he could get the king to sign it. So he went and talked it over with his bishop. And the bishop said, this would be excellent, but you must not ask the king to sign it. For if the king was to begin to sign such things, there'd be no end to it. Well, he wasn't entirely persuaded. After a couple of weeks more, he came back to the bishop and put the same request over again. And the bishop said, you can't ask the king to sign a certificate like that. Then the bishop, thinking that he might sort of dampen his ardor, said, maybe, he said, you could just tell the king about these people who had been so good, and I'll see if I can't arrange to have an audience with the king for you. But he said, I will not, well, his face lit up right away, and he'd be very happy for that, but he said, I will not arrange it unless you will promise two things. You will not stay any longer than 10 minutes. And you mustn't ask the king to sign this certificate. He promised. After he'd had his audience, he came back jubilant to the bishop. And the bishop said, did you stay only 10 minutes? He says, no. He says, the king kept me there for 25 minutes. And he said, then the king said, now will you please go out into another lounge and wait there? For he says, Trigvali has an appointment with me. But don't mind, he said, he won't be here more than 10 minutes. So after Trigvali had gone, this man came back in. And they continued for another 25 minutes. Well, I think the king understood that here was a man of the people, and this gave him an opportunity to really put his finger on the pulse of the people. Then the bishop asked, now you didn't ask him to sign that certificate, did you? And he got flushed in his face. So the bishop said, now tell me the truth. Well, he said, I didn't ask him, but I told him that you had told me that I mustn't ask him. I think that's beautiful. To which the king had said, the bishop is right, he said. If I were to do that, he said, I wouldn't get anything else done. Well, then he felt satisfied. The king is really a man of principle, and I think of conscious Christian faith. I was there some years earlier to represent the ELC, that was before the Union of 1960, when the Norwegian Mission Society was celebrating its 125th anniversary. And after we'd had the program, then we left again to the Atlantic Hotel, and there was a luncheon there, a very brief program. Then we were waiting, some were ready to leave, but you don't leave until the king leaves. And the king got up, and everyone thought he was now leaving. But he just raised himself from the chair, and then began talking to the group. And what he said was the equivalent of a sermon. And the public relations man for the Norwegian Mission Society was just kicking himself all over for not having had a microphone handy at that moment. For you couldn't ask the king to write it out, and he spoke spontaneously in reaction to the observation that, the observance that was being celebrated. Now, he is coming to this country, and he will be visiting in the New York area, the Chicago area, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Seattle, Tacoma, San Francisco area, Los Angeles. He will make a few trips, quick trips, like, for example, to Northfield and to Decorah, Iowa. But the principal celebrations will be in those places. This is under the auspices of local committees in these areas, and then we've had the chairman and one other person represent us on a coordinating committee. And these celebrations will be largely that cultural nature, historical, and observing those things that one would observe with a Norwegian group. There'll be some folk dances in many instances. In Minneapolis, we happen to have one man who is related to Thor Heyerdahl, and he has succeeded in getting Thor Heyerdahl to come, and on Sunday afternoon he'll give a lecture. I think it'll be in Central Lutheran Church. He's the Kon-Tiki man, a man of Kon-Tiki fame. And we'll have for one dinner, they'll have all those of Norwegian ancestry who have been awarded a Nobel Peace Prize. Borlaug will be there and some others. And then some other Americans who have achieved. And they will have something that will try to be a replica of the sloop. And that will be on display, I believe, at the First National Bank. And Humphrey will be on the job October 9th when the first announcement and sale of a special 150th anniversary stamp will be put before the American public and made available to them. Of course, the banquets that will be held in each place where the king will be the primary guest, you can't bring everybody that wishes, and the freight is pretty high. In New York, it'll be $50 for a banquet seat. In Minneapolis and most of the other places, it'll be $25. After the king gets through in these areas, and he's really got, I've got a copy of his itinerary, and it's very carefully delineated, and he's got something to do almost continually. Someone asked one of the attendants, one of the guards who was with the king, whether this wasn't a bit wearying for the king. Oh, he said, His Majesty just enjoys this, he said. And he is, seems to be strong, his usual hearty self at the age of 72 years. When he finishes up at Los Angeles, at least so the itinerary indicates, he'll go up to Anchorage, Alaska. There are quite a few people of Norwegian background, and probably put in a brief appearance there. Then he goes to Prudhoe Bay to observe the oil drilling that is going on there. He has interest in that, of course, with all the oil drilling that's being done in the North Sea today. And then he flies back over the North Pole. It'll be almost 30 days that he will invest during the period that he is over here. Now, along with these various committees, and in some places where there is no committee to arrange for a cultural celebration, there will be a church committee. President Knudsen asked if I would represent the ALC on that committee, and when Dr. Price came into office, he reappointed me. So I've served as the chairman of the church committee, and the church committee, consisting of seven people, has gone through some changes because people who were on the committee moved out of the Minneapolis area, and since we needed to meet quite frequently, we wanted people in that general area. But the church committee appointed a chairman in each of 16 areas. And then he would, in consultation with the district president, add to that committee as many as they thought desirable. So there's been a committee of this kind in the New York area, in the Chicago area, in Madison, Wisconsin, Decorah, Iowa, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, Minnesota, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Fargo, Moorhead, Minot, Williston, Great Falls, Seattle, Tacoma, Portland area, San Francisco area, Los Angeles area, and then northern Texas in the area of Clifton and Bosque County. For there it is that Clayne Pearson was buried. His grave is at the Norse congregation, so-called, out in the open country. The General Committee has said to each local committee that the objective in these services should be thanksgiving to God and then dedication to some of those stalwart values that were there in the life of the immigrant fathers. It's interesting to observe that Hans Nielsen Helge died in 1824. The year before the Restoration sailed. Had the immigrants come from Norway 50 or 100 years earlier, I think we would have had a different story. I do not think we would have had what came to be the Norwegian Lutheran Church and then was called ELC, and the Lutheran Free Church, and now both a part of the ALC. I don't think we would have had the kind of church that came into being. For Norway, before Hans Nielsen Hauge's period, was a church that was largely formalistic, and there wasn't much of community emphasis, and the peasants that constituted 95% of the population, they were the peasants. They were not the people of wealth to be esteemed. Then came Hans Nilsson Hauge, a farmer boy, who had a stirring conversion. This came upon him. He'd been reading the Bible a great deal. And while he was out plowing, and he was singing the hymn, "Jesus, I long for your blessed communion," suddenly there came over him a certainty that Christ was his Savior, and that he was called to share this witness with others. And so he started to preach wherever people would come together. And one thing that I had not known in the degree that is been made known to me now was what I read in what is today probably the definitive biography on Hans Nilsson Hauge, called Through Obedighet, Faithfulness and Obedience, or Faith and Obedience. And this book is an effort not only to tell the historical events, but to try to trace, to see if he could get at that which was the key in Hans Nilsson Hauge's faith commitment. And Andreas Orflot, who is a theological professor in Norway, was over here last fall. He is the author of the book. And he says there is no question in his mind, but what the compelling thought in Hans Nilsson Hauge's faith was, that we are stewards of God. And stewards in all realms of life. So Hans Nilsson Hauge, observing that there wasn't much of trade and there wasn't much activity except as people came from outside of Norway, he began to be concerned about this side. And he would pick out a man to go as an evangelist to a given community. And if it was a community that didn't have a mill, he would select an evangelist who had some background and knowledge there. And if it was something else they didn't need in a given, or that they needed in a given community, he'd pick a man for that. And thus, well, there are several students of Hans Nilsson Hauge who say that there was a rebirth of Norway as a nation and also as Christians. In fact, a man like the Danish critic George Brandes says, Christianity came to Norway with Hans Nilsson Hauge. Now, it had been there hundreds of years before that, but what he meant was that it came alive and it became something which meant a great deal to the people. Well, now he was in prison a good deal at the time, but he did his work prior to the time of this group, in the last part of the previous century, then on into the 19th century. And it seems to me we can say that a prepared people went out on the boat restoration, and many of those people who came as immigrants to the United States, they were a prepared people. Professor Blagan, who was dean of the graduate school at the University of Minnesota, grew up in the Lutheran Free Church. He has a book that he calls Norwegian Immigration to America, and he is reputed to be the expert on the letters that people sent back to Norway and that they got from the people of Norway. And he said, so many of these letters overflow with Christian sentiment, with pietistic points of view, that he said many of the immigrants were committed people. Now, there were others also that came, but these coming early, it seems to me, laid the foundation for the church to grow up as it did. Now, I got some dividends in addition to participating in the celebration. I preached in the Trondheim Dome on June 29th. And those of you who've been there know that is really a big church. But lo and behold, here it was full. But that which probably filled it, aside from the celebration, because this was also part of the sesquicentennial celebration, was that there had been a meeting on Friday and Saturday of choirs from different parts of Norway, and quite a few of them stayed over for that service. Then at Stavanger on July 6th, which was supposed to be a service specially for Americans, I preached there in Stavanger in the Dome Church. And this was televised, and I was indeed grateful that there were not lights heating you up. Very few lights, but they had cameras that were so good that they got perfect pictures, because that afternoon I was in the home of the chairman of the church council of the cathedral, and there were a group of other people there. And he announced at the hour, I think it was 6:30, that we must gather at the TV. And the projection was excellent. One thing I wish people in this country, when they project a service, would do that they follow over there. You know, here, when the congregation sings, the camera roves, usually at least, over the congregation. You might even catch somebody nodding a bit, somebody picking his nose. But during that time, they project on the screen the hymn that is being sung. And spontaneously, that group that I was sitting with just joined right in and sang. You felt that you were a part of the service. I wish, I'm telling you, whenever I meet TV people here, I tell them, can't you try to do something like that when you project a service? On Saturday, a journalist whom I'd met over here and who knew the place where my father was born and grew up, took us out to the Gore where he had grown up. Well, I can get sentimental at that point. I just want to say that my wife roved around all over that place, and she found downstairs an old yoke, you know, that you carried a pail of water on either side and neck yoke. And she got some horseshoes and she got some old doorknobs that the man who now lives there said, I know that was there at the time that my father had lived there. So she took care of that water yoke as carefully as though it should have been a child she was carrying. She wouldn't pack that up any place. She carried it right with her on the plane. I think probably that's all that I want to say about that. But we ought to stop to pause that it's not only a 150th anniversary of a great event for those of Norwegian ancestry. Oh, by the way, I must not overlook. We will have two bishops from Norway that will be with us. Dr. Price and I went over there and participated, and they are coming here to participate. They won't be able to reach around to all 16 areas, but they will get to 12 of the areas, and Dr. Price and I will take care of the other four. We tried to get Bishop Stalen of Oslo to consent to loading three services into one day. And being in different cities, that's not easy. And he wrote back and he says, well, if you say so, I'll try, but we've got a saying here in Norway, to preach one sermon is a pleasure. To preach two is work. To preach three is to try to kill a man. It runs a little more smoothly in the Norwegian the way he quoted it. We ought to recall that we are ready now to step into the bicentennial year. of the United States of America.
Fred, before you go into that, may I
put
in two or three remarks?
Yes, indeed.
In the first place, in your summary of the places where the king would be, you had to omit some, but you omitted one which is very important to us because he is going to visit Norway, Illinois, where my father was pastor for many, many years, and near which Gladys was born, and where her eldest sister presently lives, and where I was born just a few miles away from that. So he is going to visit what they consider to be, as it were, the cradle of the Norwegian settlement in the United States. And he's going to dedicate the monument there to Clang Persson, which has been moved from its original place.
I'm glad you called attention to that, because that recalls for me a very lively discussion in the area committee whether the king would really have time to go out there. And they bombarded the Norwegian ambassador in Washington because he's the one who has control of where he goes. And that was worked into the schedule.
The second observation that I would like to make is the fact that I've always been very grateful that my own father was a Haugianer and a leader in the Hauge movement in this country. So that when you spoke as you did of what Hans Nielsen Hauge did, I could hear, of course, the echoes in my own life of what I saw and heard in the life of my own father. So this is very meaningful to us. And then the final comment I would like to make, I'm very grateful that the king is also going to visit PLU.
Yes.
Where, in all probability, we shall have the opportunity of meeting. We've already been involved in some parts of the celebration in the Seattle-Tacoma area, but the plans are made for his visit to PLU.
Are you going to make him an alumnus of PLU?
I don't know what they're going to do. I no longer have any responsibility for the official acts of the university.
Well, he's got a great concern to reach out. I wonder whether you ought not to go back to Illinois for that period.
Yeah, it would be very wonderful. I don't know how they're going to take care of the tens of thousands of people who are going to crowd into that little wide place in the road, which is called Norway, and where I have been hundreds of times, of course, in my life. And the little church where my father preached so often, right across the street from the old store that's been there for over 100 years and operated by the same family, a Danish family, by the way. The place where my family bought its first halibut and lutefisk in years long gone by. And so I don't know how they're going to do it, but I know from the clippings that are sent to us frequently by her sister and other friends that they're going to make it a wing-ding of a celebration.
A Lutheran Church Missouri Synod layman sent me some information from New York about the Sloopers from the period that they were there. So he was showing a great deal of interest in what was happening. We have had a kit prepared, that is by the ALC, sent out to all congregations that were members of the former ELC or Lutheran Free Church, with the announcement others that might want could request it, and a number of others have asked for it, and some LCA congregations have written in. And we sort of thought that there are a couple of Norwegian independent churches that really won't have anything to do with us, but since they have Norwegian background, maybe we should send to them too. So we wrote to the president of what's called the Little Norwegian Synod and also the Association of Free Churches, and they responded with such warmth, I didn't think they had it in their bosom toward us. And so we sent them a compliment. And quite a number of congregations have celebrated this. And they will be going on after the king is gone. St. Olaf College has its in connection with its foundation day. So it'll be going on probably for some time. Well, there are other things, and if you have questions and we have some time left, we can. But I'd like to at least touch on, there are going to be many books that you will be able to buy, and I'm sure there are going to be many programs on TV study your TV guides with care, and you'll be able to spot a number of very worthwhile programs during 1976, which is the 200th anniversary of the formation of the United States of America. You know, we think back, I can remember when I was in school, we were asked to read Patrick Henry's speech where he says, "Give me liberty or give me death," and stirred up the Virginia legislature to vote in favor of going along in the revolution. And there are some interesting stories in that period. There are some places where it seems to me, except for God's providence, it might not have come to pass that this became an independent nation. Well, when the war was over, we have always thought probably that they, just 13 colonies, agreed to go together. But then the troubles started. At the Constituting Assembly, many of them felt, well, we went into this war to win our freedom from Great Britain, but as 13 independent colonies. And then Patrick Henry made another speech. This kind of thing went on in that assembly for almost a whole summer. And then at the point where they would have to come to a decision, and they weren't sure which way the vote would tilt, then Benjamin Franklin, an older person, he was the elder statesman then among them, he got up and he said, "As I have studied the back of that chair, which is occupied by the chairman," and that was George Washington, "I see there a carving of a sun." But he said, "I have not been sure, as I've sat through these sessions, whether this is a setting sun or it's a rising sun." Then he concluded by saying, "I want to believe that this is a rising sun." And there were others who joined in those sentiments. And when the vote came, the Constitution that had been drafted was adopted. But then, of course, it had to be ratified in all of the 13 legislatures. And it was tough going, some. But thank God that it was ratified. Had it not been, the story of our country would have been a completely different thing than what it has been.